It's Wednesday, the 19th of February, 2025, and this is Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast with David Taylor and Phil Bishop. I'm back again to discuss some of the news stories that have broken over the past couple of weeks. Fair amount of politics in this one, Phil, though luckily, well, I don't know, a little bit of Trump, I suppose. We're talking about...
Okay.
There's been a lot of Trump in the last couple of days.
Oh, we'll save that for later, I think.
Yeah.
Don't want to have people switching off too quickly. Because there might be something on the other side. Do you have other sides of podcasts? I don't know.
I don't know.
Turn your phone over or whatever you're listening to. Yeah, right. Okay, the first thing I would like to talk about this morning, David, is the whole question of exploding batteries, which is not a new thing, but I had... something came into our intrays the other day from Hire Association Europe, or as they are now rather clunkily known, Hire Association Europe and Event Hire Association. I think they need to work on their branding.
But split personality.
Yeah, well, it's two organisations that came together.
Yeah, I know.
My microphone's away from me. I'll just bring that a bit closer. I hope that helps.
That's a bit better.
They're basically on a public awareness or industry awareness campaign, which coincides with the passage of, well, it hasn't been passed yet, but there is a private members bill that was placed in the House of Lords last year, and it's in the committee stages in the House of Lords at the moment, called the Lithium Iron Battery Safety Bill, which I don't think says a huge amount. It just basically makes provision for the safe storage, use and disposal of lithium-ion batteries. In other words, it's going to put some legislation, say, you know, you're not allowed to chuck them in any old bin. And you have to do certain things when you use them and charge them up.
Yeah.
Now, you're the scientist in the family, David.
Oh, I wouldn't say... No, I'm not. I've got three children. They're all scientists, but I'm not one.
Well, there you go.
some of it's rubbed off on me.
There's some science. I have no science. Why are lithium-ion batteries so prone to exploding?
Well, I probably know no more about this than you do, Phil, but they're prone to something called... Is it sort of... they sort of generate heat and it sort of runs away. And I don't know, maybe if they get overcharged or if they're charged at the... You know, at a higher voltage or current than they should be, they can overheat and then they can explode. And I mean, as you say, it's not a new thing because I mean, we've been using lithium-ion batteries in things like, mobile phones and laptops and tablet computers for a couple of decades now at least. So I'm sure everybody has heard stories, horror stories about. Mobile phone batteries exploding when they're being charged and stuff like that. I've never actually seen it happen myself, but it's not that uncommon. But of course, now we're using lithium ion batteries for a lot more than just sort of handheld devices. And, you know, we've got a lot of battery cars now. And of course, we're supposed to be having a lot more of them. And this extends to on-site equipment. So hand tools, a lot of wireless sort of battery-powered hand tools use powerful lithium-ion batteries. And, of course, even small plant nowadays can be operated using these lithium-ion batteries, which have a huge energy density. If you think about it, you've got sort of 8 hours of operation built into a battery for, a mini excavator. That's an awful lot of energy. And if that... goes pop, then, well, you know about it. It's serious stuff.
I did a quick bit of reading on this, so I realised it was beyond my level of knowledge. And it seems that apparently the batteries in... I mean, electric cars are much less likely to explode than, in fact, less likely to catch fire than petrol or diesel cars. We have heard of, they do get reported, there's a big scare, mm-hmm. Oh, electric car's dangerous. But apparently, according to my rapid research, on the whole, the car manufacturers are using really good top-of-the-range batteries, mm-hmm. and phones, laptops, expensive bits of kit tend to be using well-made, good-quality batteries, therefore they're basically safe.
Yeah.
Safe as anything is in life. The where things tend to be, I mean, and the fire brigade apparently it's about one a day that they seem to be, here's the stats. UK Fire Services attended 921 fires linked to lithium ion batteries in 2023. So that's more than one a day. That's about three a day, in broad terms. So it's quite a regular occurrence. And I think why it's happening more and more is it's not the expensive kit that's catching. It's e-scooters, e-bikes, and more particularly hand power tools. Because if I buy a power tool from, you know, middle of Lidl or B&Q or something, the battery element of it is much less expensive, essentially, than the sort of batteries which are going into more expensive kit. And a lot of people, it seems, are going on the internet saying, oh, I need a spare battery pack. There's one from Amazon for whatever price. I don't need to pay all that money. I'll just get this one. And apparently there seems to be quite a lot of not terribly well made, high quality batteries, and that matters. And also, if you overcharge, charging to 100%, which is a common thing to do, you go to bed at night, stick your battery into charge, and come back in the morning. Apparently, that's bad practice. You shouldn't charge it up to 100%.
Really?
Apparently. I mean,
I do that with my phone every night.
Well, I have been told, I mean, my wife's more techie than I am on these things. She says, no, you should always charge your phone, your laptop, your iPad, whatever, up to about 90% is best practice. Never run it down, never fully charge it, just keep it. And it'll last for longer, I am told. I'm sure listeners will tell me that we're wrong in this household and we should, you know, fully charge it. I don't know. But anyway. I guess you should always read the manufacturer's instructions. Yeah. Anyway, going back to the Hire Association Europe call, they're basically saying, number one, read the instruction manual. And some wonderful good advice. Don't use your batteries as hammers.
Yes, I noticed that as well. Well, I mean, they're quite heavy. They feel solid. They're quite heavy. And you think, well, I could get that nailing, just give it a tap with this battery.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's exactly the sort of thing I would do, to be fair, if it's the nearest thing to hand. But there's some other, you know, things that you mightn't necessarily think about. Keep batteries away from other metal objects like screws, nails, washers, as they can short the terminals.
Yeah.
Always use a suitable carry case. Don't touch the battery poles with your fingers. Keep batteries away from rain, moisture, salts, and other corrosive materials. Fairly obvious one. Don't incinerate batteries. Don't try to disassemble them. And only use chargers recommended by the manufacturer.
Yeah, I think that's I think that's a big issue, because I've heard previously about people who, for example, have either lost or damaged a charger and have bought a cheap one off Temu or somewhere like that, you know, some sort of dirt cheap thing off the internet, and it's not rated, it's not compatible with the battery they want to charge. So they plug the battery in. Of course, the socket works, you can plug it in, but the power rating is wrong, and so it overcharges or it overheats the battery, and that's where you get an explosion. So I think that's probably a very important thing. Make sure that the charger that you actually use with the battery is the correct one, the one which is recommended or supplied by the battery supplier as well. I mean, I'm a bit worried now, actually, Phil, because I've got an electric drill, like a lot of DIYers, a battery electric drill. It's a very good one. I've had it a long time. Nothing wrong with that, but the battery has died, and it's from it's from a well-known make. I won't mention them.
Why don't you mention the make, and then you might get a free one?
Oh, that's true. It is a DeWalt. I didn't take much persuading. No, I don't know why. I don't know why I didn't mention them, actually. I don't work for the BBC.
So DeWalt, if you're listening, David needs a new drill, please, or at least a battery.
Well, a new drill would be nice, actually. But no. So I bought two new batteries, and one is still working, but another one conked out very soon after I got it. So, yeah, there's clearly a quality issue there. I certainly don't charge that overnight. I charge it when I need it charged. But, yes, if you can imagine the sort of damage done by a big industrial lithium-ion battery overheating and bursting into flames or exploding, then, you know, that's pretty serious stuff. And there was another press release. I don't know if it it certainly coincided with the HAE.
I was going to say that they came about 15 minutes apart, and I don't think that's a coincidence. I think there's been some smart dovetailing going on. Go on.
It was a contractor. Was it Wilmot Dixon? Yeah, Wilmot Dixon.
It wasn't from them. It's from the manufacturer of cabinets.
That's right, yeah. They'd had an incident on one of their sites where, they've got this rather robust-looking steel cabinet on site, which has got individual compartments inside it where you stick your batteries overnight. I imagine that they're charging in these compartments.
Plug stock in the back of each cabinet.
Right, okay.
It's a bit like left luggage lockers at the
railway station. Yes, exactly, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, this chap who, I don't know, is a project manager or the senior build manager, a chap called Gavin Coleman, came to work the following morning, opened up this compartment and found that one of the batteries had actually exploded. And in fact, there's a photograph which you've posted on the website now. It looks like the inside of a wood-burning stove, actually. The door's open, everything inside it is blackened and just cinders.
Looks like my oven when I stay at the pub too long on Sunday.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's pretty impressive. And there's some sort of staining around. Obviously, these compartments work because I don't think the fire spread to any other part of it. But I think this is just the manufacturer of this cabinet wants to, I was going to say jump on the bandwagon. That is not fair. They're actually doing something positive.
It's a real problem.
Actually, tackle this problem. Yeah, they want people to become aware that there are solutions, and this is clearly one that works. I think Wilmot Dixon were saved an awful lot of cost and bother because the fire was contained.
But I can imagine most construction sites wouldn't have an expensive cabinet like this. And they would just charge their batteries in the changing hut or whatever. And I don't know how fireproof site huts are. I'm sure they must have some sort of level of fire.
Oh, sure,
protection.
Yeah.
But it would certainly do a lot more damage.
Yeah.
And you do wonder how many of these construction site fires. It's often hot works which are to blame, but you wonder how many actually caused by exploding lithium-ion batteries.
Probably not a large proportion, but I imagine that the risk, the incidence, is bound to increase because of the increased use of, sort of cordless hand tools and other equipment which uses, sort of these powerful batteries. So I think clearly this is it's a problem which probably hasn't been considered to be a particularly widespread or serious problem. It's just isolated incidents so far. But I think that with the increased use of these tools and other items of equipment, we're going to see a lot more of this.
You said talk about the increase. I mentioned the UK Fire Service stats and that 921 fires linked to these batteries in 2023. That was 46% higher than just the year before. So I don't know what the 2024 stats are. Obviously, not just power tools, but these scooters and electric bikes have become huge in the past couple of years, a big growing things.
Yeah.
So I think they're a big part of it.
And you ever had a battery explode on you, Phil?
Many, many years ago, shortly after there'd been, I can't remember, some activists had planted but I don't know if they're animal rights activists or what their thing was, but they planted a sort of a nail bomb or something at a door of a supermarket or something like that, and caused damage and scare, but not much. I don't know who was hurt, but I'm going back to the 1990s here. And I was just driving quite close to the scene of this supermarket in London, driving past. And I hadn't suddenly heard this almighty bang and flash in front of my eyes. And I thought, oh, good Lord, it's happened again. And I realised what it was, the little disposable cigarette lighter was sitting on the dashboard on a hot, sunny day.
No.
And the sun had, been magnified from the car windscreen.
And it had blown up.
Blown up the cigarette lighter.
Blimey.
I mean, no harm done. The car didn't catch out. Nothing like that. It was just a, you know.
But, oh,
it, fortunately, I was actually parked at traffic lights. I think had I been in the outside lane of a motorway or something, it could have been a different story. But
yeah,
it made me jump, and it took me about 5 seconds to work out what had just happened.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. Not surprised at all. I've only known of one incident of a lithium-ion battery exploding, and it didn't happen to me, but to a friend of mine who had a very powerful torch, a sort of flashlight.
No, we call them torches in this country, don't we?
Torches, yeah. This was definitely an American one, so it probably was called a flashlight, sitting on his desk. And he swears blind that it wasn't plugged in. It wasn't actually charging at the time. He went out to the shops or something like that, just went out on an errand. When he came back, there was a sort of a fog of smoke and fumes in his office, which he couldn't, to begin with, couldn't figure out what it was. And then he noticed that the window behind his desk had a hole in it. And his first thought was that it was somebody had fired a gun. And of course, he couldn't understand that. There were no guns in his office. And then he noticed that on his desk, this torch was no longer on his desk. It was lying on the floor in front of his desk in pieces. And this was part of the torch, which had exploded and fired part of the socket or something like that at the window and actually punched a hole in it. It was a double glazed window and it only penetrated the inside part of the window, but it still broke it. And he said, well, you know, if he'd been sitting at his desk, he would have been right in front of it. Ooh. So, you know, it could have been very, very unpleasant. And I mean, if that happens spontaneously, then it does make you wonder how safe these things are. I suspect, actually, that he had it plugged in and it was charging, but he reckons he didn't, so.
You got me worried now. I've got a couple of, you see them now, really quite good, tiny little torches, which you can get for like a tenner, which a USB cable charge them.
Oh,
like
yes,
that.
Yes.
And they're fabulous, but I'm now thinking the price they charge, they're so cheap. You're thinking, oh, yeah. How safe are they? I'm not going to leave one of those charging overnight again, I don't think.
No, certainly not. Well, anyway, so be warned. Make sure that you charge your electrical equipment correctly, using the right charger and the right battery.
And don't leave them unattended, I'd suggest.
No, definitely. Yeah. Definitely not.
Right, now we're scared, everyone. Let's what should we talk about now.
Let's talk about the environment, which is a topic which crops up with considerable regularity on this podcast. We're talking about the biodiversity net gain regulations, this requirement, BNG for short. Now a year old. The government introduced it last year. The idea is that every development, and initially it was just large-scale developments, I think, does it only apply to greenfield sites? I think it probably does. But each development must actually deliver, as well as the project itself, it must deliver a 10% improvement in biodiversity. So if you're building, say, I don't know, let's say you're building an office building. Obviously, if it's on a greenfield site and you've dug up the ground, got rid of a load of grass and hedges and bushes and all the rest of it, maybe moved a water course. After you've built your office block, the immediate environment needs to have improved in terms of biodiversity by 10%. Which is a great idea. Of course, we worry about biodiversity, you know, species dying out and all the rest of it and habitats being degraded. So if you can deliver a 10% improvement every time you build something, well, that's obviously a win-win. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem to have panned out quite as the government expected. In fact, it seems to have been a damp squib, Phil.
Well, yes, various organisations have been commenting and doing and talking about BNG, which I'm going to say because it's much easier to say BNG than
yes.
biodiversity net gain. Lots of people commenting on BNG, how it's going. We reported on TerraQuest, the people behind Planning Portal, had done. They monitor planning applications across the local authorities, planning authorities around the country. That's their line of work, and they're basically saying that more than 75% of Non-householder planning applications have claimed exemptions from BNG requirements since the policy came into effect last year. They're sort of suggesting it's all a bit of a damp squib, and which I think is a bit unfair, because one of the major exemptions you can claim is that your planning application was lodged before the rules came in. Now, it's planning takes a long time, and I think quite a lot of these public planning applications could probably quite legitimately say that they, you know, were exempt because they were lodged too early. But there is a wider story about the lack of... We haven't exactly hit the ground running with this policy. The developers don't really quite know how to handle it. There is a new industry growing up of the whole offsetting industry, and BNG consultants, you know, give us money and we'll plant some trees somewhere for you. And therefore,
basically what it boils down to.
You don't have to, you know, if you're putting up a housing estate on the edge of town, you don't have to necessarily put a duck pond in the middle of that estate and put some frog spawn in, although you could, and that's quite a nice way of doing it. You can get away with, in certain situations, of paying some agency some money to, you know, plant trees in Ecuador or something. Mm. Or even, there is supposed to be, but I don't think it's up and running yet, a government fund. So you can just bung the government some money and say, yeah, that's that box ticked.
That'll disappear. That'll disappear into a black hole somewhere.
Well, it's supposed to go to, is it Natural England? It was expected to be running some sort of offsetting thing. And we've heard about this with other aspects of offsetting as well. But the offsetting fund doesn't seem to be up and running yet. And the local authorities are all implementing it in different ways and they don't quite know what they're supposed to be doing. And there's a question marks about whether anyone's actually checking. Whether you simply fill in the form, say, I'm going to do this, and the planners go, yep, tick, okay, they say they're going to do this. And they don't have the people or the resources or perhaps even the interest to go around later and say, right, let's see where these trees are that you promised.
Yeah.
And let's see whether that frog spawn has actually turned into frogs or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
So the policing of it is up in the air. Now, I was looking at this, there's a... another organisation called Wildlife and Countryside Link, which is basically lots of greeny charities like the RSPB, Wildlife Trust, Friends of the Earth, etc., Rivers Trust, lots of people come together. And they put out a report, did a bit of a study, based on freedom of information requests to 317 local authorities in England. And I think it is just England we're talking about with these rules. I think for Wales and Scotland, it's a devolved thing. And I don't
know
whether they are in the process of implementing something similar or have no plans to. I don't know. But in the 317 local authorities in England were submitted this questionnaire back in October, asking how they're getting on. Now, one thing to me was particularly interesting. The legislation does allow local authorities to set their own local requirement for more than 10%. The 10% is the minimum 10%.
Okay.
But they can't just do it willy-nilly. There has to be some sort of justification and conditions for they do it. Anyway, four local authorities out of the 300 and whatever it was have adopted a 20% by a BNG requirement.
Right, okay.
One of them is my very own Maidstone Borough Council. The others are Guildford, Mole Valley and Worthing. So all parts of Home Counties sort of area. I don't know if you can call Worthing Home Counties, but southeast. Actually, it is. Sussex?
Yeah, I would have thought so.
I was reading an article the other day. It was arguing about what we should call Home Counties and whatnot. Anyway, they're all firmly in the southeast of England.
Yes.
For birds, and all quite broadly leafy and present, although Guildford's a bit urban and Maidstone can be a bit skanky. So they got 20%. So that's, I don't know how whether they're being policed, but that's quite interesting. There are some people asking for more than 10%.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, the general view of the Wildlife Brigade, just read some random quotes. BNG is full of potential, but also full of holes. Holes in ambition, which remains limited to just about offsetting harms to habitats. Holes in implementation and holes in enforcement.
Yeah.
1 year on, it's clear that this scheme is a huge missed opportunity that's currently failing on all counts. These findings show that the BNG scheme is not being prioritised enough by the government. If these trends continue, then nature once again risks becoming an afterthought. In other words, it doesn't really seem to have... The nature people are all saying it's not working.
But I think it must be difficult to make it work, though.
It's too soon. I think...
You know, it's only a year.
Yeah.
But also... I don't know what metrics they're using to actually measure. I mean, how do you measure 10% biodiversity net gain? Because, I mean, there are so many ways you can enhance the environment. You can, as you say, you can, a bit of frog spawn here, a few trees there. You know, you can plant wildflowers. You can
Who takes your homework? I mean, if you're doing your baseline starting point, what is the biodiversity level of the site I'm going to build on? You can say, well, there's some dandelions there, but they're weeds, so we won't count them. Oh, you know, a seagull's just flown over, but we won't count that because he obviously lives somewhere else. He's just flying past.
Yeah.
I'm sure you can score down at your starting point and score up at your end point and going, oh, look, there's another seagull. We'll count him as in our end result. There must be scope for manipulation of the measurements.
There must be. I mean, I think the only way you could possibly do it is to count all the species within the curtilage of the development. I mean, presumably that's including everything from mammals and birds down to amoeba.
Earthworms. But you can't count the earthworms. You have to dig up the whole site, dig up all the earthworms. Yeah, oh shit, we'll just kill them all. But at least we know how many there were.
Yes. Yeah, and how many we need to replace them with. Yeah, I just don't understand how it's done. Maybe somebody could tell us, because I imagine that they can't introduce something like this without actually providing some sort of guidance as to how you go about actually administering it.
Well, there is a growing industry, and Planning Portal among people who are part of it, and loads of people are trying to cash in on this industry of being BNG consultants. Yeah. Do your accounting for you. And I don't know what the auditing process is, whether it has to be some sort of third party, but if the developer is paying the consultant is going to tell the developer what the developer wants to do. They're going to come up with the right answer.
Yes.
Otherwise, they won't get the job next time round.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's no such thing as independent third party in this context.
No.
As we saw with the whole, let's go back to Grenfell with... the testing houses and the building products said,
yes.
Oh, yeah, that complies. The BRE will give you a tick and a certificate for that because you're paying them to do that.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so I think it's a similar sort of situation. Maybe not with quite such disastrous results, but it does make it seem... those comments that you read out just now, I think, are entirely justified. They seem to hit the nail on the head as far as I can see.
But I still think it's bedding in. I mean, I think it's acceptable to have a new policy. I mean, the bad thing, both the construction industry and for the government with its 1.5 million new homes ambition, is that it will all contribute to a hiatus in house building,
yes,
and development and economic activity. But there's certain inevitability that when you change the rules, that's going to happen, and it's going to take a while. VAR in football, I mean, that's still sort of bedding in and oh, how's that working out and whatever. But there's no real going backwards from it.
No, I think you're right. I do think it's a good idea to encourage people to improve the environment in all sorts of ways, you know, biodiversity being just one way of doing it, making the, you know, our built environment healthier and more vibrant and just nicer overall. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I just think that the problem here, and I think we can see it emerging, is that if it isn't clear how this requirement should be administered or how it should be checked or policed, then people will set themselves up as, you know, arbiters of how it should be done, and then, as you say, it'll just create a job opportunity for somebody else without actually achieving what it set out to do.
I'm not sure I like that. I mean, I agree with what you're saying, but I think I'd rather it was sort of ground up led, rather than it being a central government saying, you know, you must do this. I think planning is a local issue.
Yes.
And I'd much rather the local authorities simply said, look, you know, we're encouraged to look at every planning application and go, this looks a bit rubbish. If you're putting that estate there, we want, you know, a duck pond and a nature trail. Trouble is, if every local authority insisted on duck ponds, the 5 years' time, the story would be about the whole waves of toddlers drowning in duck ponds, and why are we letting these duck ponds exist? So, you know, every action has an equal and opposite reaction.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I do know that there's a sort of proliferation of ecological consultants. Because my daughter, who is a marine biologist, has been looking for job opportunities in this sector. And there's basically an ecological consultant on every street corner. And it's not the sort of industry that pays an awful lot. But clearly
they're chicken counters.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, it is basically a contractor or a developer will enlist the help of an organisation like this. To basically do the paperwork for them. And I think that's basically what it is.
Well, I'm sure they can't. Most of these people haven't got the resources to do that themselves. Because you say no. It does all just come down to paperwork. And it's not just for the developers, it's for the local authorities too. And as we know, their planning departments are completely overstretched.
Yeah.
So it's yay, more bureaucracy.
Should we go international? Should we go global?
Well, you said you want to talk about Donald Trump. I don't.
Well, we don't have to talk about Donald Trump, although there is a suggestion. We said on the podcast last time, you know, whether or not Trump's introduction of new trade tariffs is going to have an effect on the UK construction industry. And I think we agreed that sooner or later it's bound to. We're already seeing signs that this is happening because there's an organisation called MAKE, which is a trade association for manufacturers. I think that's probably a best way of describing it, has warned that Trump's tariffs on the import of aluminium and steel, but particularly aluminium, is affecting the UK industry already.
Well, it shouldn't actually, because as I heard someone say or read someone say the other day, that they're not putting tariffs on aluminium, they're putting tariffs on aluminum. And we don't make or sell aluminium. So we're okay.
Yeah. I don't think that's going to work, Phil, actually.
Probably not. Sorry,
I'm sure there'll be people out there who will say, we'll be able to convince us that aluminum is the correct pronunciation.
It's not the pronunciation, they spell it wrong as well. But yeah, you're saying that the Make UK are saying that it's having an impact on the aluminium producers and processors.
One interesting thing they said, which I hadn't realised, they mentioned that UK producers and processors are already tackling the negative consequences of Russian aluminium being dumped on European UK markets through third countries. That's sneaky, isn't it?
Yes, I don't know.
We're not supposed to be, you know, taking Russian aluminium, for God's sake, but yeah.
Yes, Rusal, the world's second largest aluminium company. The largest one is Chinese, but Rusal. Founded by Oleg Deripaska, who I've heard of, one of the big oligarchs.
Ah, yes.
But whether Rusal only produce in Russia or whether they've got manufacturing plants in other parts of the world and therefore it's coming from them in other parts of the world, I don't know. Anyway, yes, as you said, there's something odd going on with Russian aluminium.
Well, I don't know anything about the UK aluminium industry, Phil. I mean, I know that we had a steel industry and we've got the vestiges of one still, though they're completely foreign owned. But as for aluminium, no idea. I mean, I don't think we've got, is it borax that, what's the stuff that you get aluminium from? The only thing I know about aluminium is it's very expensive to produce because it's an electrical process.
And it's light.
Yeah.
That's all I know about it.
But whatever the ore is, I didn't think that we actually produced any, but maybe we import.
I think we process it. There is something called the Aluminium Federation, ALFED, and its membership is our members. Okay, this doesn't make great radio, does it? A pair of looking things up. and my computer's gone slow.
Sorry, I've just been Googling as well. It's bauxite. Bauxite is the stuff you make aluminium from. But I don't know what the UK bauxite reserves are. I can't think of any bauxite mines.
Yeah, no, it looks like the manufacturer, sorry, the members of the Aluminium Alliance are all stockists and processors and shapers and finishers and whatever. So I don't think we do produce aluminium. But we certainly do produce steel. As you said, it's not exactly British Steel anymore. In fact, British Steel, the company, is Chinese-owned. Tata is our other big steel producer, and the third biggest is a Spanish company. I don't know if it's pronounced Celsa or Kelsa or Celsa, but C-E-L-S-A, I think it's spelled.
They make rebar.
They're big in rebar, correct? Yes. So they're very much in the construction industry. And this came to my mind when the British Construction Steelworkers Association put out a statement last week saying that it's clients have got to stop giving foreign companies steel contracts over British companies. Now, I suspect what they're really meaning is not so much, you know, protecting British Steel and Tata, because then they employ British people, and we'd rather the contracts went to steel companies that produced in the UK than didn't produce in the UK. But I think mainly their interest, the BCSA, the British Construction Steelworkers Association, their prime members are people like Severfield, Billington, William Hare, and these
fabricators, contractors,
people actually supply and put up the steel beams on, you know, bridges and football stadiums and so on.
Yeah.
And the release they put out was saying clients, particularly public sector clients, they're killing British industry every time they bring in a foreign company. And I said, well, come on, name names. Who are you talking about? I said, we don't want to do that. We don't want to do that. So I had to Google it myself to try and find out which clients were over. And lo and behold, it's HS2 and Suffolk County Council have both given contracts to Victor Buick, the Dutch steel company.
Oh, yes.
And there've been others, but that was the first one I found in illustration. The Gullwing Bridge in Lowestoft. And
that's Dutch, yeah, okay.
I mean, fair to HS2, it wasn't HS2 Limited who awarded the contract for Victor Buick. It was one of the, I think it was in the Midlands. I haven't got this in front of me now, but one of the construction groups. But they've got so many foreign construction companies, okay, with British bases, building HS2, whether it's, you know, Vinci and Skanska and what have you, it would seem churlish to say, okay, that's foreign enough, no more foreign, thanks. but I'm not. I don't know, this by British first, it sort of seems, as Trump is riding this wave, and I'm sure Farage would say the same, as it's like, you know, we've got to support our own. Something in the papers this morning about Nigel Farage saying British people have got to have more babies because Judeo-Christian population is at risk. I thought, Tom's going to beat that. heaven's sake. No, I can't say heaven's sake in that crap.
Well,
the pity's sake. No, you can't. Pity's sake. That's what I mean to say. Pity's sake. Broadly speaking, I'm a free marketeer on these things. And you know, your German car or your Japanese car is better than your Austin Princess, I don't think you should have to buy an Austin Princess or a Maestro or an Allegro. I mean,
well, having said that, I mean, British steelwork companies have a fantastic reputation, and you know, I think I know that America.
No, absolutely nothing wrong with them. But as soon as you say you must buy British, then, you know, cartel situation, and the prices will go up and the quality will go down, so they'll get fat and lazy. So the overseas competition is essential to keep them big, strong and honest.
Well, I can think, is Watson Steel still in existence? I don't think they are they? But I can remember when they were building steel frames for things like the Kansai Airport and the Tsinghua Bridge and stuff like this. I mean, these were British construction groups with British supply chains building major infrastructure in Hong Kong, Japan, places like that. So I suppose what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. You know, we've been going out into a, you know, overseas markets and dominating them. And certainly, you know, British steelwork fabricators were massive back in, I don't know, 20 years ago or something like that.
I believe it's Severfield. One of them has got a big India subsidiary now that they started up a few years ago, which took a while to get going, but is now moving. And you're right, I would much rather hear these trade associations saying, we're going on an export drive, rather than we've got to, you know, we want to keep out the bloody foreigners.
Yeah, it does sound a bit desperate for them to say, you know, why are you giving these jobs to Dutch firms, you know, when we're here?
And the irony is, at the same time, they say, oh, government, could you relax the immigration rules? Because we need to employ lots more, you know, foreign people, get people in from Bulgaria and Albania to come and work in our workshops because we can't get the labour.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's the way. Oh, I know the point. Heathrow Airport, the reason why, another news item report on, Heathrow Airport have signed the, is it called the British Steel Charter? The Steel Charter?
Oh, that's right.
UK Steel Charter. Heathrow Airport has signed it. Basically saying we will try to give UK-based steel producers a fair chance of winning tenders. The UK Steel Charter itself is, it sounds like a great thing. I'm sure it is a great thing, but it's remarkably broad. It's got, basically it sets out guidance to people who are purchasing either steel or steel contractors. They say, procurement steps that you should take. Develop a pipeline for your organisation so that UK firms can work with you to your specification, timeline and quantity requirements. Place the requirement in the appropriate contract so the origin of steel can be recorded so that you know whether it's UK made or not. Put your adverts for contracts in places where UK companies will see them. Stipulate products must be accredited to BRE and British standards. So it's all fairly general. Where possible, use British quality standards of steel when detailing steel requirements in project plans.
Well, who's behind this? Is this the
BCSA?
This
is Make UK. No, this is Make UK.
Right, okay.
I'm sure BCSA are involved in it, but it's a Make charter. I can't remember what Make UK used to be. They changed their name from something.
Yeah, I can't remember.
Engineering Employers Federation, right. EEF. The Engineering Employers Federation is what they used to be. 2003.
Oh, right, okay.
No, tell a lie. 2003, the Engineering Employers Federation became the EEF. EEF, the Manufacturers Organization. 2019, EEF became Make.
Right.
Make UK.
Yeah, okay.
So, Heathrow, what was I saying about Heathrow? They've signed this saying, according to UK Steel trade body. So I said it was Make UK. UK Steel is a subdivision of Make UK.
Right, we've got that sorted out.
The UK Steel Charter is a vital commitment to strengthening Britain's industrial backbone, says the Director General of UK Steel.
Mm-hmm.
Heathrow signing the charter is a major vote of confidence in UK steelmaking and British business, full stop. This is because the airport, this is very weird, the airport's coming out and saying, this is on the back of Rachel Reid, said, Iceport Terminal 5, the boss of Heathrow Airport stood up and said, we like Heathrow Airport too. It's critical. We need it. And we're going to give the government some information on what we're thinking in the summer. But ahead of that, we're going to expand capacity at Terminal 2 and Terminal 4. And they said they're going to do their biggest ever investment project in the expansion of Terminal 2 and Terminal... Did I say Terminal 4?
Yes, Terminal 5,
beg your pardon. Now, Terminal 5 is pretty new, and that costs... whatever it was, that £5 or £6 billion or something.
Yeah.
So they're spending as much more than they spent on building Terminal 5 on increasing capacity at Terminals 2 and 5. And I don't think that means so much airplane capacity because there's no more runways, but passenger capacity. it's everything from shuttle buses and car parking to
retail, probably.
Probably more shops.
Yeah.
But anyway, there's going to be more building work at Heathrow long before the sometime in the distant future third runway ever gets off the ground, which it won't. So, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Apparently, Heathrow is going to use British steel, which has been made by the Chinese, Indians, and the Spanish.
Yeah. Great stuff. Oh, well, on that cynical note, Phil, have we got anything else to discuss before we leave our listeners in peace?
We've done our regulation three topics, and we've been talking for far too long. But I do just want to give, I think, three cheers for Angela Rayner.
Yes.
Who is growing on me, I have to say. She has, I reported, she's made the call that no previous Secretary of State had dared to make. Grenfell Tower is coming down. Now, I don't like to say sound insensitive about Grenfell Tower, because, you know, it is very understandably considered almost sacred, totally sacred by family and survivors of that fire. But the fire was June 2017. It was very, very rapidly evident that it was not repairable and it would have to come down at some stage. The whole thing, it just became political. Is how do you bring it down without seeming insensitive and hard-nosed and whatever? And the government managed to completely wrap themselves in expert engineering advice. In 2021, W.S. Atkins, specialist structural engineer, said, this is 4 years ago from now and 4 years after the fire, they said, unanimous agreement and unambiguous advice from all the technical experts and engineers involved in the Grenfell project that the tower should not be propped for the medium to long term, and it should be deconstructed at the earliest possible opportunity, with deconstruction commencing no later than May 2022. Now, the problem is that no Conservative ministers, a bit like Conservatives in the National Health Service, they can't make the hard decisions because everyone goes, we knew you were heartless bastards, and now you've just gone and proved it. There's certain decisions it's much easier for Labour to, because they're seen as sort of softy, lefty, you know, tree-huggy, whatever. Although I don't think Angela Rayner has been particularly soft or tree-huggy in a lot of things she's doing. But she has said that, you know, sorry, folks, I understand all the sensitivities, but it has to come down.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's unequivocal. As you said, all the engineers say, you know, it's costing an awful lot of money, isn't it, just to maintain the thing. I just don't understand why people are, I mean, I can't put myself in the position of, you know, the bereaved and survivors of the fire, but I cannot understand why people feel an attachment to basically the gutted husk of this tower.
I think it's out of sight, out of mind. There is a feeling that if it's not, so long as it's there, people think, right, the council cannot forget what happened. Sure. No one can forget it. Every time you walk past, you go, that was terrible. Yeah. That must not happen.
But that's what memorials are for. That's what memorials are there to keep the memory alive. You know, and I think there are already plans at a pretty advanced stage for a memorial garden. And
I think this is why it's been so difficult for particularly, you know, Conservative Secretary. It felt like they've had to pay regard to the feelings. But there are also strong feelings from people equally involved that they don't want to be constantly reminded.
Yeah.
They want to move on. You know, don't forget, but do move on. Don't forget and don't forgive, certainly, but do move on.
Yeah. I mean, there are more than one campaign group, which I didn't realise, because we hear about Grenfell United, and whenever people talk about the victims and their relatives, it's always Grenfell United that is quoted here. But there is another organisation representing the next of kin. I think it's called Grenfell Next of Kin, another campaign group. But they are in favour of bringing it down. As you said, they don't like the constant reminder of something which is, you know, a very painful loss to them. So, you know, it depends. It's an entirely subjective thing. And I think in the end, you have to put subjective considerations aside and just be totally practical and objective about the decisions.
Yeah, and the why now, as you mentioned, is the fig leaf that the Conservatives took for not making a decision was say, well, so long as the inquiry is going on, as if somehow there was still evidence to be found, but the police and the investigators got everything they could possibly get out of that building years ago. Yeah. But the fig leaf was that we have to wait for Sir Martin Moore-Bick's report to be published, which happened last September. So I think, Rayner inevitably got flak from some quarters for taking this decision, but I think it should be recognised that she took a decision.
Yes, difficult decision and risky for a politician. But yeah, I think that she showed a certain amount of courage and determination. As you said, I think she's gone up a couple of ticks in my estimation.
Yeah. Right. I think that's us. Unless you have anything else.
I think that's about it, Phil. We've been speaking for long enough, I reckon.
Again, yes. Right. Okay. Well, we'll be back next month, in March, next time we
see. Yes, it will indeed. Yes. Spring.
Exciting. When do the clocks go? Forward, back, forward?
Oh, not for a while, surely. It must be towards the end of March, surely.
Thanks, producer Tom, for twisting on here. Sunday the 30th of March. There's a while away, yeah.
Bye, folks.
Thank you for listening, everyone. For another week, I've been Phil Bishop and he's been David Taylor. Thank you and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.